Few minutes here won't be that value added anyway, and I hope you don't feel the same way about the last several minutes. But for those of you that don't know me, I'm Bob McPherson. This is my first year presenting at this PTC, but I'm glad to be here, and hope we all feel that way here in a few minutes again. But I was excited about doing this, and Ken approached me about it, and I thought, well, that's good. Yeah, I'll agree to do it. And I know Ken's a good guy. I'm sure he'll ease me in. Then I got the schedule, and there I was, sandwiched between J.R. Bronger and L.H. Dofer. And I thought, well, that's great. So here's two guys on my personal Mount Rushmore of gospel preachers, and I'm going to be like the halftime show. But not even like a good halftime show, but the thought that came to my mind was, have you ever been to like a big-time college basketball game? You know, you're watching that, and then it's halftime, and then the local junior pro comes out, and you get to watch the little dribblers for 20 minutes. It's kind of how I feel today. But I'm glad to be here. Glad you're here. Go ahead, open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 24. Because what I want to talk about is the Olivet Discourse. You start reading, and that's a fancy way of saying the discussion Jesus has with his disciples on the Mount of Olives. I want to talk about this. I'll spend a little more time tomorrow because I got less material to try to push through, kind of talking about what the philosophy is for what I've decided to talk about this week and that sort of thing. We'll kind of spend a little time on that in the morning, but today I wanted to go ahead and get started. And hopefully the introduction here will kind of tell you why I think this is important, and also, quite frankly, why it's been material in my work in the last year and had to talk about this idea. But when you talk about the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24 verse 1 through really Matthew 26 and verse 1, where we're told Jesus has finished with all these sayings. But you know, hopefully you recognize it as an important text because it touches some very important ideas or subjects or concepts that come up from time to time. The question really then is, what's Jesus talking about in the Matthew 24 discussion here? There are those that will say, okay, Ken, this is not working when I click. So the question is he talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, which happens in AD 70? Or is he talking about his second coming at the end of time? Is the way the question usually gets one of those two positions. Or the third option, does he talk about both in this discourse? Let me tell you why this is important, and hopefully we'll not have to say much more than this. Some that say he's only talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Not everyone who takes this view of Matthew 24 falls into this camp, but there are those who teach what you maybe have heard referred to as the AD 70 doctrine, or it's referred to as realized eschatology, that those end times things have already all happened. And as you read the list, there's some of those things that are quite important, maybe particularly the resurrection of the dead, that they believe has already happened and causes us to have to discuss this subject sometimes. But folks advocating that position will claim that Matthew 24 and 25 is only about the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of a Roman army in AD 70. And then throughout most of the religious world, the prevalence of the idea of premillennialism, the idea that Jesus will someday return and establish his kingdom and rule on this earth for 1,000 years. When you talk to folks who believe that, they will look at Matthew 24 as talking only about his second coming at the end of time. And therefore, it's an end time description by which one can recognize characteristic events that will hearken that event. That's why in the last couple years, you've heard perhaps people talk about all the back of the book is playing out. That kind of real-time view of Matthew 24 plays a part of that in the view of premillennialism. So just thinking about those two things, my position here is that it's important for us to have thought about what Jesus says on Mount Olive and to come to some sort of understanding and conclusion, because we're going to have to talk about Matthew 24 when we discuss these two ideas that we brought up. But the third idea that we talked about is many conclude that Jesus talks about both in this discourse in Matthew 24 and 25. And what I want to say here is you need to decide what you think he's talking about. And then, spoiler alert, is I'm going to tell you I'm one of these. that I believe he talks about both of those incidents here. And that's what I'm going to present to you this morning and let you think through it and maybe think about some things. And I come to that conclusion because I think the context and the language of Matthew 24 support this view. I think the setting shows that the initial subject is about the destruction of that temple. As we look at the text in a minute, what you'll see is what precipitates this exchange is Jesus literally walking out of the temple and the apostles literally commenting on the temple buildings there. So I think that is the back story of this whole exchange, and then the physical setting when they have this discussion that we'll look at in a little bit as well. But if you start reading in Matthew 24, ultimately Jesus will say things that seems to shift the discussion to a judgment that's not about a physical temporal judgment on a physical city, but he seems to talk about a judgment that will be universal, will include all nations, not just citizens in and around Jerusalem, as well as one that has eternal consequences, not just physical consequences as the destruction of a city would. So then the question, if you decide that it talks about both, is, well, where and how does Jesus transition between those two ideas? And that's what I want us to consider this morning. So ultimately what we're really talking about is rightly dividing Matthew 24. Let me suggest up front some things that the way I think about it is keys to understanding this discourse is first, Jesus describes an event with perceptible signs. And not only the perceptible, but they're such that Jesus expects his followers, you're going to be able to see these and I expect you to act on them. He's going to say, therefore when you see, flee to the mountains. And later he'll say, as he summarizes, when you see all these things, recognize. Jesus is saying you're going to be able to recognize, see these things and respond to them. Jesus also describes an event that he says will happen within the normal lifespan of his listeners. And the time text, in verse 34 of chapter 24, he's going to say, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And then also I think Jesus describes an event with no perceptible signs. So something that seems distinct from the first event we discussed, and I think the language bears that out, beginning in about verse 36 when he says, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. So I think thinking about those three things are important to coming away with an understanding of this. And then we'll just dive into the text. Again, you have Jesus coming out of the temple. If you've read chapter 23, you know the exchange he just had inside the temple. He walks out of the temple and the disciples run into him and they point out the temple buildings to him. And he says to them, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down. So Jesus walks out of the temple. His followers are there in the temple grounds pointing to the temple and all the various other buildings of the temple complex or temple structure. And you read the parallel accounts and they're talking about how magnificent these buildings are. And in Luke's account, they're talking about how the gifts that have been given have helped adorn these buildings. So they're talking about that physical structure when Jesus is responding to that and says, not one stone will be left here. And then based on the accounts we have, that was kind of the last thing Jesus said. He said it and just kept walking. And so he goes outside the temple complex and then through the gate. And his little group is following him probably as he goes down off the hill into the Kidron Valley. He crosses the brook Kidron at the base of that valley and starts up the opposite slope, which would be the Mount of Olives. And that's why the very next thing we're told in verse 3 is as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives. And now just think about this. This is one of those places where sometimes we talk about context, and really maybe in an epistle or something, context comes about literary layout, or it's kind of two-dimensional, how Paul's got his arguments arranged here. But here is a very three-dimensional idea of context, a physical setting of where they are. And now they're walking up that hill opposite of the Temple Mount, and you all have walked up hills, right? If you're walking uphill and you decide it's time to sit down and take a break, which direction are you going to face? That's just how it works. And so as they sit down here, they're looking back across the Kidron Valley at the Temple Mount. Now those astute students of history, you know, that's the Dome of the Rock now adorns the Temple Mount. That dome there, it's a Muslim holy site, the third most important Muslim holy site. But that's where the temple would have been. So the discussion we're about to dive into, Jesus and his little band of followers would have been sitting on this hillside, looking back across that valley at the Jerusalem skyline with a temple dominant in that skyline. Let me suggest to you, they were looking at these things when they came up and asked about these things. And that's the question. The disciples came to him privately, verse 3 tells us, saying, and we're told in Mark's account, I think it's just four that are named there, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. They came to him and they said, tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And I want to spend a little time here because I think it's so important as we're going to dissect the answer is that we really understand the question. And I want to suggest to you that what we actually see here are two questions that reveal a flawed premise as you break down what the disciples had said. First, what they're really asking is, tell us when will these things happen? And what they mean by that is, when will this temple be reduced to a pile of stones? Because that would have been the thing that Jesus said that really shocked them, that they'd been thinking about on that entire walk. The last thing they heard was, this is all going to be torn down. And for a first century Jew, that would have been very earth-shattering to think about that idea. So it makes sense. As soon as they had a chance, they come to Jesus and they ask, when will this happen? And that has to be, seems to be what would be in the front of their mind. But also mixed into their question is, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? In other words, I think an extension of that is when how we know this is about to happen seems to be what they're asking about. And I want you to see that the questions assume that these things will happen at the same time. That the question is based on an assumption that the physical destruction of that temple we just left and your second coming and the end of time, that all must be going to happen at the same time. And again, I think we put ourselves in the mindset of a first century Jew. The idea of that temple being done away with completely, that must just be the end of the world. That must be at the end of time. And that seems to be how they've conflated those things. I think Mark's account makes it even more clear that they expected all of this to happen at the same time. They say, tell us when will these things be and what will be the sign of when all these things are going to be fulfilled. So let me suggest to you that Jesus hears that question, but Jesus knows that the physical destruction of the Jerusalem temple in AD 70 and his second coming at the end of the time aren't going to happen at the same time. So in addition to answering the question, he's got to correct their thinking. So he's answering, but also educating as he continues through his question. I suggest that Jesus' answer corrects them by separating those two events as he answers. And here's something that becomes important to my understanding of that. We're not going to dive very deep in that because I get over my head quickly. But the Greek word parousia is used in this discourse. And you don't have to know much about it other than I want you to look at the definition and where it's used. But let me suggest that one of the places it is in verse 3 in their question. And this word is to inquire of Jesus' coming, it really underscores this expectation that I've introduced already. They thought the temple would be destroyed at the Lord's visible, personal second coming. And we say that because that's the definition of that word. When this word is used, it's the way we normally say second coming. That's be the Greek equivalent of that. What you have in mind, you have the end of time and the final judgment. That's the word they used as part of their question. I also find it interesting and informative that only Matthew of the Synoptic Gospels uses this particular word, and he only uses it in this passage. So you look at how it's used. Let me suggest to you that first in chapter 3, or verse 3, the apostles used it as part of their question, but I think we're going to see they used it incorrectly because they were conflating that destruction of the temple with his visible, personal second coming. Jesus will come back and use this word, I think, intentionally, but to contrast in verse 27 as to say, there's going to be people saying I've come back, but this ain't that. Because when I come back, when I parousia, nobody's going to have to tell you. And then once Jesus switches and begins talking about his visible, personal second coming, later in the discourse in verses 37 and 39, he uses the same word. Again, you don't have to know all of that, but I think it pays significant to help in our understanding to see how that one word is used. And similarly, another phrase, so the apostles use this word, they also use this phrase you recognize in their question, the end of the age. And that becomes important for both our understanding of their question and Jesus' answer. Let me suggest this way. Their use of end of the age is indicative of that false assumption we're talking about, that all these things would happen concurrently, and that would be at the end of the world, at the end of time. And I say that because to me it's logical that they would use that phrase in the same way that they had heard Jesus use it, in the same way that Matthew had recorded it and consistently records it and uses it. For example, if you go back to Matthew chapter 13, there are two parables that Jesus tells. And when he explains the parable of the tares, his conclusion is this: so just as the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so it shall be at the end of the age. Later in that same chapter, in explaining the parable of the dragnet, Jesus says, so it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth and take out the wicked from among the righteous and will throw them into the furnace of fire. And the point being that in both these parables, Jesus seems to use end of the age to talk about the final judgment that will occur at His second coming. And so that's how Jesus has used the term the end of the age. And if you're in Matthew 13, you'll notice that verse 51, Jesus says, hey, have y'all understood everything I've been talking about? And in verse 51, the disciples say yes. So that's how they say they understood then His use of the end of the age. And then another one that shows not only the use of it, but Matthew's consistent use of it, I think is compelling from chapter 28 that you're familiar with. Jesus says, lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. I don't know anyone who understands that to mean I'll be with you until AD 70. So I think you see consistent use by Matthew, Jesus, and the apostles of this phrase to talk about the end of time and the end of the world, which further shows that they had conflated these ideas in their question. I believe that phrase, with its clear tie to His second coming, to the end of time and the final judgment, is also important because Jesus doesn't use that back to them when He starts to answer and declutter these or delink these ideas to them. Jesus doesn't use that phrase that He's used before to talk about the end of time. He doesn't use it because He knows they misused it. Because again, Jesus knew that the end for the temple in AD 70 and the would come well before the end of the age, the end of time, the end of the world, His visible personal second coming and final judgment. And my point is this, that Jesus in His answer immediately begins to try to untangle His confusion of His questioners. So Jesus doesn't use end of the age back to them, but you will notice He uses the term the end. And His use of the end, I think, refers to the end that they were asking about. The end that prompted their question was what He had said was going to happen to that temple they're looking at across the valley now. And Jesus uses the term the end, I think, to talk about that, with one exception. Peruse or scan down through the rest of chapter 24 with me, and you'll see there in verse 6, Jesus uses the end this way. He's going to say, hey, look, there's going to be these natural and societal upheavals that are going to happen the next 30 or so years. In verse 6, He says, but that is not yet the end. Now look at verse 13. I think this is the exception. He's talking about the things that are going to apply specifically to His followers and tells them you need to persevere through that. And the way He uses it there, He uses the end in a sense is talking about their personal salvation, being faithful to the end. And I would suggest there that that end is just as personal as that endurance and that salvation is. He's not talking about a historic event. He's talking about if you be faithful to your end, you will be saved. And I think Luke sheds some light on that in his Gospel, that same phrase, a parallel phrase there, is worded this way: by your endurance you will gain your lives. So I think Matthew 24:13 is the exception to the way Jesus uses that phrase, the end. But then down in verse 14, having warned them not to be deluded by those false signs before verse 6, He says in verse 14, and then the end will come. And He immediately identifies a definite sign of the impending end for the temple and the city by mentioning the sign of the prophet Daniel. The end then in verse 16 and 14 is the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. What do I do?
I don't know where Dad is.
Wake him up.
Work better fills the mat.
Yeah. But think about this. So Jesus uses this phrase, the end, and again, look at verse 6, verse 14. He's talking about the impending move of that Roman army on Jerusalem. This isn't it yet. This is it, with the sign of Daniel pointing to it. And then back in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 26, this is what Daniel had been told. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood. So I think there's a connection there between that language as well.
We'll go to the HDMI cable.
Okay, tomorrow. What I need to, there's something I can hit or push when it does that?
It'll take you a while, it'll throw you off. You
gotta hit this,
wait for this. Let's just, I'll stay in here and we'll get him finished and then we'll do it later. I'm sorry, brother.
That's okay. So all that to say the importance of understanding the apostle's question, because that will set up the way Jesus is going to answer. And let me suggest to you, Jesus answers, I think, in the simplest way you would answer any complicated question, is sequentially. So he looks across at these fishermen from up in northern part of Judea there. And let me suggest, think about Matthew 24 this way. First, Jesus is going to tell them, this is kind of what it's going to look like the next 30-ish years, until about AD 66. And he's going to say, those things are going to take place, but that's not yet the end. And then at the close of that period, I think he'll say, then the end will come. Verse 14 ends that way. And then immediately in verse 15, I think he switches to talk about the Roman campaign and siege. And that's a four-year period. I don't really think about that, but armies, Roman armies appeared in the area in and around Jerusalem in 66 AD. So at that time, he's going to say, that's the sign of the abomination of desolation that Daniel spoke about. And during these days, there will be great tribulation. So the word tribulation becomes important to our understanding of the rest of the chapter. And it seems to describe this period of time that Jesus is talking about. And the one that I don't think we always notice, as I break out this separately, I think, is the actual fall of the city. And we'll talk when we get there about how that is a very distinct event from the campaign and the siege. But when Jerusalem finally falls, Jesus will say immediately. So immediately, I think, is an important word. And it's after the tribulation, which describes that period of time we've already talked about, of those days. And then that becomes an important idea, because ultimately then Jesus moves on to the second coming. And I'll suggest to you that there, verse 36, he's going to switch from using days, plural, which he's used to describe what he's talked about previously, and says, but of that day, an hour, no one knows. I'm going to present it that way. I think Jesus, these men have asked that, and Jesus is now going to present to them an answer to their questions in a sequential manner. And his point is, first, beware of misleading signs. Look there, you peruse through verses 4 through 8. I won't read all of them for you. But as you think about that, what Jesus warns them of first, you think about even in a modern time, people see certain things, societal upheaval, natural disasters, and what do they think? Oh, this must be the beginning of the end times. This must be it, right again, in the last 2 years. Oh, the back of the book's playing out. And ancient people weren't that different from modern people in that sense. So Jesus says, you're going to see some things that are misleading signs. There's going to be false messiahs. And if you look a little bit at first century Jewish history, you realize that was more commonplace than you might think. Josephus records multiple incidents of that, or reports about them. And you think about this. If you thought that most Jews had this idea that the Messianic kingdom was going to be a military power, if you wanted to become politically prominent in first century Judea, you claim to be the Messiah, you're going to get some followers, right? So be politically expedient, maybe explain why somebody would do that. But again, historians record that. Wars and rumors of wars throughout the Roman Empire, that would be the case. Natural disasters, like we talked about, will cause people to think these kind of things. And even specifically, Jesus mentions earthquakes. But earthquakes, they just happen, right? And even historians record multiple earthquakes happened to plague the Roman Empire during the intervening years that Jesus talked about here. The point is, Jesus said, you're going to see some things, you're going to wonder, does this precipitate the end? And he says, no, these things are merely the beginnings of birth pangs. So his first warning is warn them against false signs. But the thing about this first chunk of verses 4 through 8, these are things that might make you think that, but these are things that are going to impact or affect everyone. And then Jesus narrows it down to tribulation that will be specific to his people, to his followers. There will be tribulation for the faithful as you look at verses 9 through 14 of Jesus' answer. And he tells them, you'll be delivered to authorities and hated and killed for my name. And you know you don't have to get very far in the book of Acts to see that to be the case. Many will fall away. Think of Demas as maybe the most famous example here, but these things are going to happen. False prophets will arise and mislead many. Think of the Judaizers or other false teachers that we see dealt with very early in the spreading of the gospel. And Jesus' assessment is some of that, what I would call most people's love to grow cold. And while this might be a very depressing set of circumstances to explain to his followers, mixed in with that, Jesus says, but you're going to be doing some important work. Because before this end comes, the gospel of the kingdom will be spread to the whole world. That's what you guys are going to be busy doing the next 30 years. And as you think about this chronologically and as a time marker, let me suggest to you that Paul in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 23 says, the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, which I think we best understand as mean throughout the Roman Empire at the time, but that would have been about AD 63. So if you're following along on the timeline, that would be indication that that part, as Jesus had predicted, was done before we got to the end. Because Jesus, look at that list again. This is what it's going to look like for you guys the next 30 years. And then he ends verse 14 by saying, and then the end shall come. And immediately when he says, then the end shall come, he goes to the definitive sign. When the end comes, you will see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. Let the reader understand. Let me suggest to you, I think that little parenthetical is Matthew's addition to say, hey, you guys remember what Jesus said? Because he does expect those who listen to do something with this information. But this is what Jesus says, so it's important we think about what he means by the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. Enough time to go into all of this, but if you think back to previous study on Daniel, Daniel uses this language, the abomination of desolation, a couple times with reference to the Seleucid ruler Antiochus Epiphanes. It's in Daniel 11 and 12. I'll just suggest to you that that doesn't fit within a prophetic timeline that Jesus is talking about. But that's a couple uses of Daniel of that phrase, and neither reference, again, will fit where we are in history to what Jesus is talking about. But Daniel does in Daniel 9:27, if you want to turn over there and look and see, Daniel uses the phrase, the idea of a language of abomination and desolation in a reference that does pertain to destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The New American Standard renders it this way, on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even unto a complete destruction, one that has been decreed. And I think it's even clearer if you ever peek over and look at how the CSB words this. CSB says, the abomination of desolation will be on a wing of the temple until the decreed destruction is poured out. So Daniel uses this phrase here, and it's included as part of the vision of the 70 weeks. So if you go back to Daniel and you see the response to the prayer of national repentance where Daniel has prayed and says, what will be the future of the city and your people? And the answer contains this outline of the 70 weeks that Daniel is given as his answer. And we're told that the decreed destruction then that's talked about in Daniel ties this prophecy to the end of the temple, the Jewish system, at the hands of a Roman army that will happen in AD 70. Again, not time to go into it, but if you understand the layout of the book of Daniel, you get that outline of the vision of 70 weeks there at the end of chapter 9, and then the intervening chapters kind of fill in the gaps, and it concludes at the beginning of chapter 12. But I want you to notice there at chapter 12 as that history is being kind of brought to a close to the destruction of Jerusalem, I believe. The language in Daniel 12:1 says this, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been seen since there was a nation till that time. And just notice that phrase, how Daniel was told what it's going to look like when the people of the prince come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. That concludes the chronology after that vision of 70 weeks is kind of fleshed out. And it ties the two events together, the vision of 70 weeks, the destruction of Jerusalem that Jesus is talking about. And you see that because of Jesus' language. A little later here in Matthew 24, when he's talking about what's going to happen, he says the time of distress has never occurred since there was a nation until that time. I think that's the sign of Daniel that Jesus is talking about that has to do with what he's telling his followers here. So that's the sign of Daniel. And even if, without looking back to figure out what it is, in contemporary times, there's another way to identify what's being said there. The key to identifying it is the response. Because you notice in Matthew's account, the sign of abomination, the spoken of Daniel, when you see that, whatever that is, the response is to flee into the mountains. Well, by consulting the parallel account in Luke, Luke says you make that same response when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. So that gives us an idea of what is that sign? That's that Roman army moving on Jerusalem. Because look, the commanded response is the same to those two ideas. Those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. So one more phrase there in verse 15 that's worth commenting on. That is, Jesus says, standing in the holy place. And I say that because I think reflexively when you read that, that sounds like an intrusion into the temple, doesn't it? And that would kind of mess up the sequential nature of the timeline that I suggest to you. Let me say that, think about this though. By the time the Roman armies breached the temple wall, it'd be too late to flee. It'd be too late to get out of Judea and avoid this thing altogether by the time the Roman armies breached the temple wall. So I think this language is better understood as the presence of a pagan army in and around the holy city generally and its environs. It's an abomination because here's this Gentile pagan army and its desolation because of what they end up doing to Jerusalem. But don't think of it that way. Instead, I think standing in the holy place really just further ties this to and connects with some of the language we see in Daniel toward the end of chapter 11 when talking about the king that will come to destroy Jerusalem. And I think by this time in Daniel 11, he's talking about Rome. He says, he will pinch his tits of the royal pavilion between the sea and the beautiful holy mountain. It's the idea of the holy place is all of that area in and around Jerusalem. Let's think of the way the language is used here. Because again, you're supposed to respond to that sign, and Jesus says that's when you know to flee to the mountains. When that happens, hey, my followers need to get out. And so as you peruse verses 16 through 22, and it's language you're familiar with, having studied this text before, now what this is the rational steps that you need to take when you see this Roman army bearing down on Jerusalem. And it just makes perfect sense. When you see this happening, get out. Don't let anything slow you down. And when you're talking about trying to grab your family and get out, it's going to be harder if you have small children or you're expecting. Very practical language here. You know what? You hope when the time comes and the day that you decide to get out there, hope it's not terrible weather. If it's wet or muddy or if it's cold and snowing, it's harder to travel and to get away. You know why? To be inconvenient if it's on the Sabbath. The travel restrictions in place, maybe some gates would be closed that would obscure or block your path. So just some very practical language here about getting out of there when you see this sign that Jesus tells his followers here. Because he says it's going to be worse than anything that ever happened. And that's the language that he used. In fact, he's going to say if it's not for divine compassion, none would survive. Let me suggest that some of the divine compassion we see here are the warnings from Daniel. And Jesus telling you guys, get out. If you'll listen to what I say, Matthew put in parentheses, let the reader understand. That's divine compassion demonstrated by allowing his people to get out. As he says, if not for the sake of the elect these days, but for the sake of the elect these days will be cut short. Historians tell us that Christians take heed to this warning and that they escaped and moved primarily maybe to Pella or surrounding areas, but most Christians got out of Judea and Jerusalem before the fall of the city and destruction of the temple, before the violence could spread and maybe endanger them as well. But as you peruse the language there in verses 16 through 22, there's this prolonged period of time where you can see signs and get out. And that's indicated, I think, by Jesus' use of the word days. Again, this maybe seems simplistic, but he uses this plural here, and that's an important part of the context. Because it does describe that protracted time period between the arrival of a Roman force in the region, that sign from Daniel, and then that final assault on Jerusalem. And these days, again, a protracted amount of time because it provides that period of time and a window to escape. And it's during these days that he says there'll be unprecedented tribulation then. And those days would be cut short for the sake of the elect. So I think it's important to think about this as a protracted amount of time. Armies take time to move. A siege, by definition, is a war is an attrition thing. Sieges take time because you surround the city and just wait for them to starve out and then surrender. So we're talking about things that by design and by nature are protracted amounts of time. But that becomes important because, again, it's a contrast. This period of time described as days, and then when Jesus gets to verse 36, he's going to talk about that day. And then an important thing to pick up, I think, again, as Jesus unpacks this, I believe, sequentially, is during these days, there will be false reports of my return. Now look at verses 23 through 27 as we kind of talk through some of the main ideas here. Because what I want you to think about is, particularly, if you're thinking about realized eschatology, AD 70 doctrine, I would say this is Jesus' commentary on the AD 70 doctrine. A doctrine which primarily suggests that Jesus returned visibly during the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. But look at what Jesus says about that beginning in verse 23. Okay. You guys read 23 through 27 while me and Vanna White are working on the screen up here.
Vanna White's not as pretty in person.
Those fantasies will always let you down.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Last time we're doing this.
All right. This is tribulation, right?
It'd work better if it was a Mac.
Oh, we spent $1,600 for it.
If you spend $1,600 on a Mac, it'll work.
Let me switch to paper and just talk. Somebody yell when it comes back up.
I thought that the person who tries to justify their purchase the most is the one that knows they got ripped off.
No. I'm just evangelizing the good news.
Okay, so then Matthew 24, verses 23 through 27. You've had time to read that. You're welcome. Gave you a little time there. But I want you to see what the overall tenor of what Jesus' comments are. Basically says, don't believe those who announce my return. Basically, I'm warning you, false messiahs and false prophets will try to mislead. And he says, if you hear that I have returned, don't believe it. That's what Jesus is saying there. Because when I do come back, no one will have to be told. I think that's ultimately what he's saying. That's why in verse 27, it's important there to know that Jesus now uses that word, parousia, to describe his personal visible return. And he says, hey, when I come back, the coming of the Son of Man, my parousia, my second coming at the end of time and final judgment, it's going to be like lightning coming from the east, flashes to the west. So will be the second coming of the Son of Man. Jesus says, when I come back, nobody's going to have to try to convince you. It's going to be that obvious. And I heard Kyle Pope say something at a study recently that I thought made a lot of sense. If anyone undertakes to try to convince you that the second coming has already occurred, that's proof that it hasn't. Because when Jesus comes back the second time, no one's going to have to be told. And again, Jesus' use of that word parousia in this context, I think, makes that contrast. When I come back, no one's going to have to be told. And then ultimately, move on to verse 28, Jesus is saying, but this will be the end for the nation of Israel. He uses that phrase there, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And depending on what translation you're using, that may come out a couple different ways. Some, the King James says the eagles will be gathered, and there's just a couple different ways maybe to look at that. Where I'm at now, I think vultures is probably better, because I think vultures is a reference back to those false prophets and false messiahs that he mentions in verse 24. That seems to be the antecedent for that, that they'll be there at the end of the city of Jerusalem and the Jewish system. But eagles is interesting, because usually when you think of eagles, it brings to mind the imagery of the Roman legions, who certainly were encircling and ascending on Jerusalem at that time. And that's why it does, because their standards often were an eagle that would look like that when the Roman legions moved. And here's actually even one that's been retrieved. So I kind of wish I still thought it was eagles, because I think that's pretty cool. But it seems to me he's talking about those vultures, those false messiahs and false prophets that would try to mislead the people. But then that's where I think the next break comes, because he's been talking about the tribulation of those days. And then he says, but immediately after the tribulation of those days in verse 29. And I think immediately becomes important here. And here's my, again, sequential and as simple as possible answer to them, those men, and thankfully for Bob McPherson this many years later. Simply letting immediately mean immediately, letting it have its natural meaning in this place, seems to both establish the timing for what he's talking about, and we're at the point for the climactic fall of the city of Jerusalem. And here's the thing I think maybe we miss sometimes, it's a subtle thing, but let me tell you, in military planning and campaign planning, a siege and the final assault are two different phases of the campaign. It ceases being a siege the second you have that breakthrough and it becomes that final assault. And now think about this. You're a Jew living somewhere else in the Roman Empire. You hear through the grapevine, the holy city is surrounded. You feel kind of bad about that. I mean, that worries you. But it's a whole different ballgame when you hear, and it's been completely razed and the temple's been destroyed. So I suggest to you that this is that fall of the city. It happens immediately after the tribulation of those days. And remember, those days we've already seen was that protracted time that described the Roman campaign and the siege. Recall it was then, those days, that there would be that great tribulation. So I would suggest here that there's no compelling reason to use a modified meaning of the word immediately. Now, you go and you read some commentaries, you realize that word sometimes is used and doesn't mean immediately like we think of immediately. And I wouldn't dispute that. But in this context, there seems to be no reason not to let immediately simply mean immediately. As soon as that breakthrough happened, that siege became a final assault on and the fall of Jerusalem. And now when you think about that, separate that protracted siege from the actual fall of the city, destruction of the temple, well, here comes that climactic end time language to describe that destruction of his city and that destruction of the sanctuary. And that makes these words and this language make more sense to me, I think. His language here describes specifically the fall of Jerusalem. And in using the kind of language, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light, the stars will not fall, it is the same type of figurative prophetic language of God's righteous judgment upon nations that we've seen throughout the Old Testament. And here's just some quotes from scholars that talk about that sort of thing, that it echoes God's historical judgment on cities and nations. And let's look at a few examples of that. If you go back to the Old Testament, look at prophetic language about God coming in judgment figuratively, but destroying cities and nations against Babylon. For the stars of the heaven and their constellations will not flash and will not give forth their light. When he talks about coming in judgment against Egypt, and when I extinguish you, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars, and I will cover the sun with a cloud. So you can see the similarity in language. And even when he talks about judging Israel, I will display wonders in the sky and on the earth, blood, fire, columns of smoke, the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. So this language, this apocalyptic language, is representative of God coming in judgment. Figuratively, not a literal visible coming, but a coming in judgment. And I think it's what we see here. And I think it's even interesting that Peter quotes from Joel 2 and Acts 2. Because really what he's announcing there is the beginning of the end for the Mosaic age and for the Jewish economy. But the use of this figurative cosmological language in this section describes the fall of the city. And again, think what that means. No more temple. No more Levitical records. No more priesthood. No more sacrifice. Even though Jesus' death had caused the sacrifice to cease in the sense it had no more meaning, now it's literally done. And so all those ideas of the ending of that first covenant are now complete with the destruction of Jerusalem and close of that chapter. And I think, again, this idea fits with the sequential flow of this discourse. And this language demonstrates the significance of that divine judgment upon Jerusalem. And this understanding aligns with the clear wording of verse 34, that this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Perhaps some of the hardest language then to think about is in verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man. But Jesus tells us, listeners, and the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And an automatic question is, well, what is it going to... But he goes, this is what you're going to see. So I think he answers his question very, very straightforwardly here. The sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. All right. We're going to finish on paper. The slides were really good, though, I'm telling you.
It was actually... I believe it.
We'll have to see him.
Yeah. So find out where I'm at now. That's all right. Verse 30. So no more wireless, right? So in verse 30, Jesus says, the sign of the Son of Man appearing will be in the sky. And then he goes on to describe what they will see. So I think the sign then is simply the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And so I think Jesus is saying the sign you're going to see is what I'm telling you today in AD 30 taking place. It actually happening proves that I'm the Son of Man at the right hand ascended and have called this down and this has happened. And the sign will simply be the fulfillment of this prophesied judgment on Israel. Which makes sense when he says the tribes of the earth will mourn. Again, probably a reference to Jews all over the Roman Empire. When they hear that Jerusalem has been destroyed, would have caused a great deal of anxiety for them. And different historians have commented on that and made that observation. But the word here that gives us trouble is the sign of the Son of Man coming. So let's kind of wrap up here talking about that. Because this is a coming, but not the second coming. This is a coming of the Son of Man in judgment on Israel. The Son of the Man coming, and you don't have to be a Greek scholar, I'm not, to know that's a different word than parousia. Jesus here uses a different word to say what is going to happen in AD 70, the sign of the Man coming on the clouds. And I think that's to be understood in the sense of Him coming in judgment on Jerusalem. Not a visible second a return or second coming. And we see this kind of language elsewhere. Again, going back to the Old Testament, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. That's predicting God coming in judgment against Egypt. Jesus Himself uses this same language, even in the book of Matthew, to talk about events other than His personal, visible second coming. You're familiar with these passages in Matthew 18, which I think is kind of a parallel to Mark 9:1. Maybe you're more familiar with. Jesus says, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom, which I think we understood as being fulfilled on the day of Pentecost. In Matthew 26, a little later, here where He's being tried, I think He's turning the table on His accusers. As the Jewish high priest is trying Him, are You the Son of God? Jesus says, one of these days, a little later, about AD 70, you're going to know I'm the Son of God. And I think He's referencing that judgment here when He says, I tell you hereafter, you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, coming in the clouds of heaven. Is a reference to the exact thing He said, is talking about chapter 24. That you're going to know I was the Son of God here in Your presence, but what's when you see what I do to Jerusalem in AD 70. So Jesus, the point here, Jesus uses the word coming Himself to not talk about a personal, visible return to the earth or a second coming. So the Son then is coming in judgment on Israel. And then in verse 31, I think, simply is understood as His gospel messengers that will draw from all nations. Something that we know is going to change in the new covenant. The idea then of the obstruction, if you think about the obstruction that the Jews had been to the advance of the gospel, well, that largely becomes removed at this juncture, and you start to see great growth in the church. A few more things to knock through. I'm going to go maybe a few minutes longer to make up for a... Is that cool? I won't go past the hour, though.
You have great grace upon you.
Okay, I appreciate it. Now, so, and look at Jesus starts, I think, he's got them all the way through the fall of the city, the impact of that, and I think he starts concluding here, trying to help them see what he's been talking about here. Now learn from the parable of the fig tree. Let me suggest to you, here he's using a local sign for a local event. The signs that I've been describing, the ones I wanted you to be able to see, that I said you would see, that I said you would be able to perceive so well that you could take action because of these signs, they'll be as discernible as fig leaves or the leaves on your fig trees. And just as clearly as fig leaves tell you it's summer. So to these country boys from Judea, hey, you guys know, you can tell by the fig tree when it's summer, can't you? Just like I would ask you guys from Alabama, just as clearly as the dogwoods blooming tells you it's spring. So I think Jesus uses a local sign for a local event here. When you see that coming, you can know these things are near. And then he says something in verse 34. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And here's what I think about verse 34. And I think verse 34 is very important to the understanding of this. Listen, some portions of Matthew 24 are hard to understand. I just don't think that verse 34 is. And Jesus says all these things, I think most clearly says everything we've talked about to this point. I'm summarizing here. Everything we've talked about to this point is going to take place before the normal lifespan of you guys would pass in human history. So this becomes what Kick calls the time text. And by doing that, I think what you have in verse 34 is an inspired stake in the ground as far as interpretation. If I know everything he's talked about is going to happen before these guys die, I can understand that. Now I turn my attention back to try to understand verses 28 through 31 in a way that doesn't contradict that. I think Jesus said the things that we've discussed so far will happen in this generation. And then he says what he says in verse 35. And I think this, you have to understand from the context. If you're a Jew in the first century and you're familiar with the old law, there seems to always have been some hope that, hey, but if we repent, what will God do? God will relent. God will return. God will allow us. He'll deliver us. And I think what Jesus wants to do at this point is remove that notion from his followers. I want you to know this has been decided. Like in the Old Testament when you read, until there was no remedy. There came a point when God said, no, this justice, this judgment has been decreed. I think it's what Jesus is doing here. He tells them this, and then just to crush any of that Jewish confidence and hope that maybe God still might deliver them, maybe this doesn't have to happen, Jesus says in verse 35, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. In other words, this is certain. And I think Jesus said that to emphasize the certainty of this prophecy. Despite how it makes you feel to hear this, not one stone should be left upon another in that temple. And I think Jesus was just confirming that with his language. Now exhale. Because I think now in verse 36, we get to, now about your second question. And I'll suggest you go back and look at verse 3. The disciples, I don't think, know for sure they asked two questions. But Jesus does. Because Jesus knew that the destruction of Jerusalem and final judgment, the second coming in the time, weren't going to happen at the same time. So now they'd ask about when are these things, the destruction of Jerusalem, going to happen. And they said, well, when's the sign of your parousia at the end of time, at the end of the age? So Jesus knew they asked two questions, and now he switches to answer that question again in a sequential manner. Because beginning in verse 36, he says, but of that day and hour, no one knows. And here I believe he switches from to discuss his second coming and the end of time, the other two elements of their question. And he says that day and hour. So Jesus knew that these things that they'd ask about and his second coming were two distinct events. And I say that because otherwise, if you take, in my mind, if you take Matthew 24 as one event, you have this obvious, inconsistent, and I think maybe even a confusing tension that exists. When Jesus says in one part of saying, hey, the thing I'm talking about is going to be so obvious to you, I expect you to take action. And then after verse 36, he talks about the coming there as be on the alert for no one knows when it's going to happen. It seems to be hard to think about the same event being described that way. And then again, you've seen how much Jesus has used the plural days when he discussed that protracted amount of time from the arrival of a Roman army on the scene up until the fall of Jerusalem. But now it goes to the singular day. And there's a contrast there that I think you notice. He talks about it there. More precisely, even that day and hour he talks about. And let me point this out to you. I focused mainly on Matthew 24, but this same break is perceptible in the other gospel accounts. And Mark 13 says it almost verbatim, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone." And Luke's is a little harder to see, I think, but he still talks about being on guard, or that day, singular, will not come on you suddenly like a trap. Not something you're going to be able to see coming, but be on guard so that day doesn't come on you suddenly like a trap. And I really think it's telling in Luke's account that the very next verse, 35, he says, "For so it will come upon all those on all the earth." What he's talking about there is not something that will just affect people that live in and around Jerusalem by the time he gets to verse 35 in the Gospel of Luke, I would suggest. And then, just to kind of further this idea, we're not going to dig deep anymore, but look how the rest of the discourse plays out. He starts talking about and using examples of being unprepared for an event with no warning. Again, the whole first half of the discussion was, let me tell you what it's going to look like. Let me give you some warning. Let me show you how you can get out of there. And now he's going to start talking about events for which there was no warning. He's going to talk about the days of Noah. And now we move from a fig tree, which is a local example, probably for a local event, now a universal example for a global event. He's talking about people going about their normal routines. As you read these verses, married and being married, those kind of things, you weren't living a normal life when you were surrounded by a Roman army inside the walls of Jerusalem. Life didn't go on as normal between 66 and 70 AD. But Jesus here is describing a time when people be going about their normal routine. And he introduces the language of the thief in the night. I just want you to notice that. Jesus uses it here, but you're more familiar with it probably where Paul and Peter use it in context where we genuinely would realize they're talking about the second coming, final judgment at the end of time. And then he tells of the master's return. And I think as you start to, further you read into chapter 25, whether you mean to or not, the more your mind starts to think of final judgment because of the language Jesus uses and the things he says. And even in this, I think, is a clear reference to final judgment. He talks about a place where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then as the discourse continues, moves into chapter 25, it's parables about being ready for a reckoning that you weren't expecting. It's the parable of the 10 virgins or the parable of the talents. And then he follows that with a scene of judgment. Matthew 25, 31 and following, that you're all familiar with, that he introduces by saying, "But when the Son of Man comes in His glory." And once he's finished all of that, remember this is one discussion, one answer to two questions, although the askers weren't sure of that, I think. Then we're told in Jed 26:1, then Jesus finished off his words. So very quickly, in rapid fire, here's my sales pitch, here's my conclusions, here's my where I'm at in my understanding at this juncture. In his answer, Jesus corrected his followers' mistaken conflation of the destruction of the temple and his second coming. They asked a question that revealed they believed those events would happen at the same exact time. And Jesus recognized that in their question, so his answer has to correct that. Then he warns them about false signs that are going to occur in the next several years before the Roman move on Jerusalem. He shared with them the warning signs, the tribulation, and the suffering that they could look forward to that would accompany the siege of the holy city. And then with that apocalyptic language, he foretold the climactic impact of the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of that temple that they had asked about. But here, regardless of what you think about anything we've said so far, I think here's the most important point of a study of Matthew 24 and 25. Ultimately, what Jesus does in his answer is elevate their thinking. And he replaces their immediate concern over the future destruction of the temple with a mindset that would, and brethren, I suggest, will sustain believers until final judgment at his second coming at the end of time. When Jesus says, therefore, be on alert for a day which you do not know when the Lord is coming. So here's my conclusion. I think Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem through verse 35. And then I think at verse 36, he switches to talk about his second coming at the end of time. And for my perspective, it matters. because we want to rightly divide Matthew 24. I apologize for going over a minute, and I yield the remainder of my time to lunch.
All right, we're going to get started back immediately. Colton will be speaking.